Hello and welcome to News Hour for the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. In just a moment, our main story, the US announces its intention to withdraw from a major Cold War missile treaty. We'll be looking at what that treaty actually involves and what the collapse of that treaty might mean. Also coming up in the programme, the footballer from Bahrain, now playing in Australia, having fled there as a refugee. Well, he's facing extradition back to Bahrain after being arrested on his honeymoon in Thailand.
The rest of the world understands that this is a case of retribution by the royal family of Bahrain. He spoke out several years ago, of course, against the royal family, and this is the opportunity for them to get him back. So Thailand clearly are doing the bidding of Bahrain here.
More on that coming up in about 15 minutes' time. Plus, how will Belgium's fishing industry be affected if Britain leaves the European Union without a deal? More on that coming up in this half hour too. But we are going to start in Washington, D.C., and confirmation in the past hour that the United States is pulling out of a Cold War-era arms control treaty, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or INF Treaty for short. It was signed by the U.S. and what was then the USSR back in 1987. But it's been in dispute for at least the last 5 years, with America saying that Russian missile tests put it in breach of the treaty's provisions. That was when Barack Obama was president, but it's taken until now for the Trump White House to formally start the process of abandoning the agreement. Today marks the start of a six-month process leading to full withdrawal. Here's the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo speaking just a short time ago.
Russia's violation puts millions of Europeans and Americans at greater risk. It aims to put the United States at a military disadvantage, and it undercuts the chances of moving our bilateral relationship in a better direction. It's our duty to respond appropriately. When an agreement is so brazenly disregarded and our security is so openly threatened, we must respond. Russia has refused to take any steps to return real and verifiable compliance over these 60 days. The United States will therefore suspend its obligations under the INF Treaty effective February 2nd.
Well, last year, President Trump signalled his intention to follow this course of action unless Russia changed its ways.
Russia has violated the agreement. They've been violating it for many years, and I don't know why President Obama didn't negotiate or pull out. And we're not going to let them violate a nuclear agreement and go out and do weapons, and we're not allowed to. We're the ones that have stayed in the agreement, and we've honored the agreement, but Russia has not, unfortunately, honored the agreement. So we're going to terminate the agreement. We're going to pull out.
Well, Angela Kane is a German diplomat and the former United Nations High Representative for Disarmament Affairs. There she oversaw global non-proliferation policy. I asked her what the INF Treaty was designed to achieve.
It was basically at the time of the Cold War when it was concluded between Reagan and Gorbachev, and the missiles were primarily aimed at Europe at that time because they had a range between 500 and 5,500 kilometers. And so it would only bind the United States and Russia not to deploy any missiles in that range. So it was a very important safety measure and a security measure for Europe. And what I can see is happening now with the Trump administration, and this goes to the Obama administration already. Already the Obama administration had made claims that Russia had violated that treaty, that they did have a missile that was actually in this forbidden range.
And what do you think, though? Do you think Russia has violated the treaty? I mean, as I understand it, I think just over 10 years ago, President Putin said that the treaty didn't serve Russia's interests. So it's not as if Russia wants to, well, doesn't appear to want to maintain it.
Well, now, since the only agreement is between Russia and the United States, that means that other countries like China, like Israel, or like Iran can have missiles in that range because there's no treaty forbidding it. And I think that now with the developments that are happening in Asia in particular, with the DPRK launching missiles also in that range, there has been a consideration to say, well, maybe we should look at very closely about these violations that Russia has done and be more rigorous about it. And that is coupled with the effect that the United States has withdrawn from a number of multilateral and bilateral treaties. So this fits in the pattern of the United States not wanting to be bound by any treaties that would restrict their ambit of activity.
Is it possible, though, that the treaty just isn't fit for purpose anymore? And if anything, a new treaty is needed?
to my mind, that would have been a good approach to say, let's look at this treaty, let's look whether it's fit for purpose. There have been over the years a number of comments that maybe it should be multilateralized or internationalized, meaning that other countries like China would be able to adhere to that treaty. But on the other hand, there's no incentive. Why would they join an existing treaty that was agreed between the United States and Russia? I think a new negotiation, a new multilateral negotiation to address this issue would have been extremely helpful. But it has been dragging on for a number of years. And the violations, if you say whether I can say yes or no, there are violations, I can't say that. I have to leave that up to the experts. But on the other hand, I must also say that NATO in early December has basically agreed with the assessment by the United States that the treaty was violated by Russia.
And if Russia is violating that treaty, is it because it wants to get one up on the United States, or is it in fact more worried about countries like China?
Well, if this treaty is abrogated, if the US withdraws from their treaty, that means that any restrictions on deploying any such missile within that range is gone. And that means that if the United States is now in an increased situation in terms of hostility with China, first through the trade, but also in terms of the South China Sea, then maybe they would want to deploy such missiles in that range in the Far East. I don't know what that could be, but on the other hand, that is a possibility.
There is, of course, another huge nuclear arms treaty, the START Treaty. Does this endanger that, do you think?
Very much so, because the question is, of course, why would now Russia feel bound to extend the new START treaty if this treaty was not properly dealt with, as they are saying, because they are claiming they are not violating the treaty. They've argued a number of times to have sessions with the United States, to talk to the United States, but they have not been taken up with any great enthusiasm by the Trump administration. So I think that it would be very difficult now for the Russian Federation to say, oh, yes, yes, we will extend the new START treaty, because the question is, what's in it for them?
And so who has most to fear from the US withdrawing from this intermediate treaty?
But frankly, I think it's the entire international community. Ever since John F. Kennedy, you've had treaties between the then Soviet Union, now Russia, and the United States that have limited their deployment. They've limited missiles, they've limited nuclear weapons. They have gone down tremendously in number. And all of a sudden, you are pulling out as one of the last two treaties that still exist on this edifice. And I think that is very much of a concern, because there are no new efforts to negotiate any treaties in arms control or arms limitation at all, neither between the United States and Russia, nor on a multilateral basis.
That was Angela Kane, a former UN High Representative for Disarmament Affairs. And Russia's position, just to tell you, this according to our Moscow correspondent, I mean, it's always denied that it's in breach of that treaty. It insists, this is the Kremlin, that the range of this particular missile it's been testing does comply with the INF treaty, and so says that American demands to destroy it are unacceptable. Now, the war and humanitarian crisis in Yemen regularly features on this programme. It's done so since the conflict began in 2014. But getting first-hand accounts is difficult. Reporting from Yemen, as you can imagine, is extremely dangerous. However, our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is there in the city of Aden. And she's been to a hospital that's dealing with severe cases of malnutrition, many of them children. What she found is extremely distressing.
We've come now to the main hospital here in Aden. In fact, it's the only hospital in all of the south that's treating these severe cases of malnutrition. Just going to go into one of the rooms. The mother's calling me in, a young mother, to show me her baby. Oh, the child's eye has been taken out. Oh, just skin and bones, this baby. Her face is skeletal.
I am Dr. Ramzi Ali Aliyev, director of the Sadaka Teaching Hospital.
This child, the baby,
yes,
terribly malnourished.
Terrible situation.
You can see the baby's ribs. How old is the baby?
Five months. They are from Hodeida. He has been admitted before 4 days. previously was admitted in the hospital because of the diarrhea, but later he developed swelling all over the body and has been admitted in the hospital. He's truly malnourished. When I asked her, the mother, she said he little improved.
He's improving
in comparison with the days before admission.
I'm so sorry. Why haven't you been able to feed your child?
Yes, because of the financial situation. I mean, she cannot offer for the nutritional, like milk and also nutrients, essential nutrients for this, infant.
And you can't breastfeed?
She does breastfeed. Yes, but she feels that it doesn't cover because their situation, they are IDPs coming from Hodeida.
So displaced. Mm. Yes. Where are you living?
In Sela by renting a house.
Just here in Aden?
Yes, in Aden. But the problem, there is no any financial support for them. You know, so they are like refugees from other area. There is no anyone relative for them in this area. Their situation is so bad in comparison to financial, nutritional, and social.
The situation around Hodeida is supposed to be getting better. There's less fighting with this ceasefire, which is more or less holding. Mm. Do you see this health situation improving in general?
The number is still the same. It depends on the rate of the admission. But for us, I think the rate is still the same. But I hope that in the coming days, the rate will be decreased.
And malnutrition?
And malnutrition also, if it's not from Hodeida, from Al-Makha, from Taiz, from other areas, and even from areas surrounding the Aden governorate, the other governorates.
So it's still severe?
Still, we have severe cases, no? But we hope that the rate will be decreased by time. But our hospital is offering their best. Regarding the nutritional support, medical support, everything is free.
So this is the best hospital in this region, in the south?
I think it is the only hospital dealing with this. Not only the best, the only hospital dealing with such cases. If this infant brought to another area, I think no one will accept him. Here, we accept. And we did not refuse any case.
Do you think the baby is going to get better?
I think. If we continue supporting his nutrition status, we have faced cases similar to them, and they are improved.
Do you see many cases like this?
Yeah, many cases. Not in this severity, but similar to in comparison to this. But we have a lot of number of cases have been discharged in good condition.
What's the baby's name?
Adwa.
Abu?
Adwa, like a light.
A light?
Light.
So her name means light. Mm. Oh, but it's a life of darkness for this child, 5 months old, and... Oh, but in a very severely malnourished state. But getting better.
Yes.
Lise Doucette reporting there. Still to come on the programme, our Europe reporters been to the Belgian coast, speaking to people in the fishing industry about the possible impact of a no-deal Brexit.
The Belgian fishermen were fishing already 200-300 years in British water. So that's most important coast for us.
What will happen if there's no Brexit deal?
I think a disaster.
That report's coming up in about 5 minutes' time. Our main headlines from the newsroom this hour. The United States has confirmed it will pull out of a key nuclear arms control treaty with Russia. The Italian authorities have impounded a migrant rescue ship in Sicily. And the UN refugee agencies appealed for safe passage for civilians fleeing an upsurge in fighting in Syria. This is James Menendez with NewsHour live from the BBC. Let's turn now to the case of Hakim Al-Araibi. He's a young footballer from Bahrain who plays in Australia. He's also a refugee there because in 2014 he fled his home country when he was accused of taking part in anti-government protests. He was convicted of vandalising a police station and sentenced in absentia to 10 years in prison, a charge he vehemently denies. He says he was tortured too by the Bahraini authorities. Well, in November, Hakim went from Australia to Thailand for his honeymoon. But there he was arrested on an Interpol notice issued by Bahrain. Well, today, prosecutors in Thailand asked a criminal court to consider the extradition request, despite concerns he might face further torture if he was forced to go back. I've been speaking to Craig Foster, a former captain of the Australian national soccer team, who's leading the campaign to free Hakim Al-Araibi. First, his reaction to today's legal moves.
Each step that's taken, we're not surprised, but of course we're disappointed. I think fatigue or dejection or any sense of a loss is a luxury that we don't have. I've been in contact with Hakim's wife just this evening, and we can only imagine how she's feeling. Her husband's been tortured some years ago in Bahrain. He faces that again. And with each step, her sense of desperation only increases, and that just gives us additional motivation.
The Thai authorities suggest that Hakim won't be tortured if he does have to return to Bahrain, and they've called the case a criminal one, not a political one. What do you make of that?
Well, it's clearly inaccurate. You know, the rest of the world understands that this is a case of retribution by the royal family of Bahrain. He spoke out several years ago, of course, against the royal family, and this is the opportunity for them to get him back. So Thailand clearly are doing the bidding of Bahrain here for whatever reason.
So you think they're coming under pressure from Bahrain?
Yeah, clearly they are from the start. They colluded together to put the Interpol red notice on him. That was placed on him the day that he got his visa at the Thai embassy in Melbourne. So this whole narrative from Thailand that, you know, it's a justice case, it's a criminal case. At the same time, they're saying publicly that they want to abide by international norms of law, which means that this refugee, who is a torture survivor, under their convention against torture they acceded to in 07, simply must be allowed to return home to Australia.
And I think Interpol notice was rescinded shortly afterwards, wasn't it?
It was, that's right. And that, in essence, is the whole point, is that Thailand was saying, well, Australia told us about this Interpol red notice, and so we were duty-bound to detain him. However, that was then very quickly lifted. And then they said, well, in the interim, Bahrain have emailed us suggesting that they'd like to extradite him. Nevertheless, the simple fact of the matter was that once the Interpol red notice was lifted, he should have just been returned home and there should never have been any inference of extradition.
Yeah, you mentioned FIFA at the beginning. What's this got to do with FIFA then?
FIFA now have a human rights policy which obligates all officials at every level of the game to uphold and promote and protect the human rights of everyone in and through football. So what's really interesting is that this is one of the first major cases of their commitment to that new human rights policy. And currently we'd say that's in significant and grave jeopardy and under huge question. We think that FIFA should be talking about sanctions, as should the International Olympic Committee, against both Bahrain and Thailand. We raised it with FIFA last week and we weren't able to reach agreement on that, either on A, effectiveness, or B, legality. So we're doing some legal work into that now, and given what's occurred today, we expect early next week to be back in discussion saying that there should be a threat of suspension from international sport on both these countries immediately.
So Hakim really is caught in the middle of something pretty complicated. How's he doing? Do you know?
You're right, and he's just an innocent boy. He's only 25 years old, who's doing extremely poorly, as is his wife. And rightly so, because he's a torture survivor. He's someone who was incarcerated back, 6 years ago. When he was 18, he endured torture, and therefore he knows what he's facing. I saw him last week personally for the first time. It was a very emotional experience because it's clear that it's a young man who is in deep fear of his life. So Hakim said to me, please get my wife to come and see me, because if I do get extradited, if I am sent back, he said, I know that I'll never see her again.
Former Australian football captain Craig Foster leading the campaign on behalf of Hakim Al-Araibi. And we did try to speak to the government of Bahrain and the Bahraini Football Association, but we didn't get a reply. In 2 months' time, the UK is due to leave the European Union. That's enshrined in law, but how Britain leaves is still very much open to question. The EU believes the risk of a no-deal Brexit, that's a departure without any arrangements for what follows, has increased markedly. And planning for that eventuality is being stepped up here and in Brussels. Indeed, Belgium is one of the countries that would be hardest hit if there's no deal, particularly its fishermen, because more than half of their catch comes from British waters. The BBC's Adam Fleming reports from the Belgian coast.
The Zuiderzee has arrived at the freezing quayside in Zeebrugge. The forklift truck is coming in to unload the green and red and white crates from the Zuiderzee. They spent 9 days off the coast of Cornwall and East Sussex catching cuttlefish, which means every single one of the fish being unloaded now is from British waters.
Well, yes, the boxman.
Carol is the ship's owner.
He sailed out of Plymouth. I'm coming in now here.
And was it good? I don't know if that's good or bad.
But the owner is not good enough.
Yeah, never good enough.
As an EU member, the UK has agreed access and quotas for other countries fishing in its waters until the end of this year. Carol hopes the UK sticks to those commitments, even if there's no Brexit deal. If it doesn't, he's got nowhere else to go. What will happen if there's no Brexit deal?
I think a disaster. The boat is too small to go to deeper water. I really don't know what I'm going to do.
Carol's cuttlefish and gurnard have been brought to the Flemish fish auction. Here, they're worried about the nationality of the fish, the citizenship of the catch. Yes, really. And here's why. Right now, the owner of the business, Sylvie Beckhaus, is dealing with entirely European fish. But in a no-deal Brexit, she fears that British fish caught by Belgian boats will be classed as British, not Belgian. And that's a problem.
So if UK is a third country and we import fish from a third country, we will have import verifications, and it's a high-risk fish because it's a third country fish. Which means that we have all the food safety inspections, we have all the customs inspections, and we might have import taxes. And the import taxes for our fish is between 9 and 14%. So that's going to complicate everything, as it is an ultra-fresh product, and we do not have time to wait for all those customs and food safety regulations.
The industry says the best solution is the existing Brexit deal with its 21-month transition period, which gives time to negotiate a permanent fishing treaty between the UK and the EU. For now, the representative of Belgian Fisheries, Emile Brookhart, feels caught in the middle.
I understand that Prime Minister May is now going to open up negotiations again, and that in the EU there was already responses about, well, there's not a lot of room for manoeuvring. So how this is going to end up, we don't know. I don't know.
On the Belgian coast, they're definitely worried. But there's no evidence that inland in Brussels, those concerns about no deal will turn into any concessions to the UK.
Adam Fleming reporting there from Belgium. You're listening to NewsHour. Do stay with us. Much more to come in the next half hour. Coming up next, as several pro-independence leaders prepare to go on trial, we'll be speaking to the Foreign Minister for the Regional Government of Catalonia, the Spanish region. But first to India, where the government's unveiled a budget which includes a $10 billion cash scheme for farmers in an attempt to tackle rural discontent ahead of a general election in a few months' time. With me in the studio, the BBC South Asia editor Ambarasan Etirajan. Good to have you with us. What exactly is the government promising then, farmers?
From outside, it looks like a very populist budget, just 3 months before the crucial general election when the Prime Minister Narendra Modi is seeking re-election. So this is an interim budget for the next 3 months. The most important thing in this budget is they've announced a cash scheme for farmers. We're talking about 120 million people, you know, the size of any big or twice the size of any European country, to give them about $80 a year in three installments so that it can help them to come out of any difficulties. And the second scheme is about the pension scheme for unorganized workers, those who are, you know, earning less than $200 a month. These people do not have any social security net. In India, you don't have like the way you have in Europe, like you have unemployment benefit or the old age pension. Nothing of that sort exists for most people unless and until you pay money into this. So he's now giving this money so that it can influence these people, improve the conditions of these people. At the same time, it is coming at a time when the government is facing a lot of criticism over the rising, you know, falling income of the farmers, because, you know, the farmers have been at the receiving end for the last 2 decades. More than 300,000 farmers have taken their own lives because of increasing debt.
And there have been huge protests, haven't there, as well?
There have been a number of protests in the past few months, especially in the capital, Delhi, where the farmers are demanding, we don't need this kind of dole. What we need is a better produce, a better price for our produce, number one. Two, debt relief. You know, we have been taking money from private moneylenders, from banks, help us to come out of this debt. And also the proper irrigation, water level has been depleting. This is what, farmers have been asking. In the last, there was elections to three states in India, and the BJP, the governing BJP, lost very badly. So there was huge farmers' anger in these three states, and that's why the government has come out with lots of SOPs to appease the farming community.
One other issue the government's got to deal with, unemployment, which, I mean, by most standards isn't really high, but it's a lot higher than it used to be, isn't it? Why is that?
What the Modi government has done in the past 5 years, you know, there have been the economic has been growing with 7% at the rate, but it is happening only at the top level, not at the unorganized sectors and also in the farming sector. A leaked report published in a newspaper, a government report, showed that the unemployment rate stood at 6.1%, the highest since the 1970s. And that's why the government is worried what impact it is going to have in the elections, because people are worried they're not getting jobs. The economy is growing, but it is only in the targeted areas, not in the broader, you know, in the rural areas of India. No, it's a 1.3 billion population. And that's why the government is very, very keen to reduce it.
Ambarasan Ethirajan there. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. On Monday, nine leaders of the campaign for Catalan independence are due to go on trial before Spain's Supreme Court. They face charges of rebellion, sedition, and misuse of public funds for their role in the illegal referendum of 2017, charges that carry sentences of up to 25 years in prison. That referendum called for Catalonia, a wealthy region in northeast Spain, to break away. But it wasn't allowed under Spain's constitution, and it led to a unilateral declaration of independence. And violence as the police and security forces moved in to prevent people from taking part in the referendum. While leaders of the independence movement were either arrested or, like the regional president, Carlos Puigdemont, fled into exile. Alfred Bosch is foreign minister in the Catalan government. He's currently in London. And when he came into the NewsHour studio, I asked him first whether he believes lengthy prison sentences will be handed out to his fellow Catalan leaders.
We hope not, obviously. We think this trial should not be held to start with. It doesn't help to reach a situation of talks and follow the path of dialogue with the Spanish government. But it could happen. We could be seeing some very heavy sentences any time at the end of the year. This will be a long trial, that's for sure.
Is it a political trial, do you think?
Well, obviously it is, because, look, it's a trial against members of the Catalan government and other people, but basically members of the Catalan government. Those who left the Kingdom of Spain are now free citizens wherever they are in Europe. Extradition orders have been lifted. So we obviously see there's a different attitude coming from Spanish judges in comparison to other judges in the rest of Europe. So basically we see that there is a clear will to follow this trial and to impose sentences of up to 25 years, because that's what the charges they're facing.
And they're very serious charges of rebellion for holding an illegal referendum that went against the Spanish constitution.
Rebellion, sedition. Now, the problem, and that's why we see there's no legal grounds to even hold the trials, because they should entail violence. And there was no violence on the side of the Catalan government or the Catalan people. The only violence we saw was police brutality on the day of the referendum. You were there. You covered that. The whole world saw what was going on.
Do you regret holding that referendum and that unilateral declaration of independence, given what's happened since and all the rancor and bitterness that it's opened up?
We think that we could do better if the Spanish government agrees to hold a referendum. And that's what we're looking for.
And that's why
we want to hold talks with the Spanish government.
That wasn't quite my question, though.
I know.
The Spanish government aren't here, but do you regret?
I was coming to your question. We never regret voting on a highly sensible political issue.
Do you regret holding the referendum, though, and that unilateral declaration of independence, which was illegal?
I think I answered that question. We don't regret voting, neither in that case nor in other cases. We think something like what was agreed upon in Scotland should be happening in Catalonia. People just voting freely for their own future, and that's the way you should do things.
Yes, not but that was with the agreement of the government here in London, though, wasn't it?
Of course. So the Spanish government could also agree on that. There's no reason why they shouldn't. Referendums called by autonomous communities are allowed. They're provided for in the Spanish constitution, so there's no reason why.
So why didn't you keep pushing for that? Get the agreement of the Spanish government, then hold the referendum, rather than going ahead on your own. Wouldn't have that reduced a lot of that rancor and bitterness that I mentioned?
Don't worry, we'll keep pushing for that. But obviously, if you're asking for that during years and years, and the answer is no, we don't even want to talk about that. We are not better than any other nation in the world, but we're not less. So we have every right in the world to make people vote about a decision which affects their future and about how they want to live in the future. So I think we're entitled to, in a democracy in Western Europe, in the 21st century, we're entitled to that. So there's no regrets on that. I think we did the proper thing, and we will pursue this path of a democratic solution where people can decide about which kind of country they want in the future.
If you failed through a legal referendum to gain independence, would you just accept that?
Yes, of course. We're ready to accept whatever comes out of a referendum. We really think that the important thing is that people can decide.
The contention is, though, that Catalan nationalism has turned into Catalan supremacism, that you somehow think that you're better than Spain, which is why you deserve to be separate. Is that fair?
We're not better than any other nation in the world, but we're not less than any other nation. So I think we have the right of coming of age and deciding on our own. So deciding whether we want to stick with Spain or not. But in any case, I don't think you can talk about supremacy when we've got our leaders in jail for more than 1 year now without bail. I don't think we can talk about supremacy when we have strong economic grievances, and especially strong grievances right now as we're talking. Those political prisoners are being transferred to prisons in Madrid. Now, how can you talk about supremacy when we had a crackdown when we tried to hold a vote, October 2017? How can you talk in that way when we are getting all this repression? We just want to be dealt with as citizens, as European citizens, and we appeal to the international community here in the UK, anywhere in the world, to help us in just exercising our rights. We're no better than any other citizens, but we're no less. So we need our rights, and we need a response there from the Spanish government.
Do you think you've had enough support from other European countries, from the European Union, or do you feel that you've been rather cut adrift? Because no one's really taken up your cause, have they?
Well, we've seen lots of attention, interest, and even sympathy from public opinion and the public and the media also. And that's been increasing. It's changed a lot in the last 2 or 3 years.
Not from the EU, though. You know, member countries and the political apparatus in Brussels.
But yes, obviously, that hasn't been forthcoming from diplomacy or from other states. But we think, obviously, states tend to stick together in any issue. We think that will come eventually. But first, we have to convince public opinion. It's important that you give us the chance to explain our cause through the media, because that's what might influence governments all over the European Union or the world.
Many of our listeners around the world will be wondering about a very simple question.
Please.
And if you can answer it briefly, why do you want to be separate from Spain? Why do you want to leave? Spain's a modern liberal democracy, an affluent country in global terms, very affluent. Why on earth would you want to go?
Well, it's not for economic reasons, although that can be also in the picture. It's because we want to be of age. We want to take our own decisions. Now, even more important than that, we want to have the chance to decide. We want to know who's for and who's against this project. We want to be a democratic country. And the fact that the Spanish government and Spanish power in general is not allowing that, that kind of makes us question what you were asking before. I think if it was a modern democracy, an advanced progressive country, we should be granted that right.
Do you think you'll see Catalan independence in your lifetime?
Well, I hope, yes. That's why I'm working towards that. My ideas are clear. I'm not surrendering on my ideas, nor is the Catalan government, which obeys a majority in Parliament, in the Catalan Parliament, in favour of independence. It's been growing in the last few years, so I think that's unavoidable. If powers of the state and Spain keep making all those mistakes, like sending people to jail and charging them with up to 25 years, which is more than the charges for homicide or rape, for people who didn't do anything bad because they didn't hurt anybody, they didn't steal anything, they're charged with organizing a vote. Now, if Spain keeps doing those mistakes, yes, I think we'll become independent sooner than later.
And that was Alfred Bosch, who's the foreign minister of the Catalan regional government, speaking to me in the NewsHour studio not long ago. Now, it was a public assassination that shocked Myanmar. 2 years ago, the prominent Muslim lawyer Ko Ni was murdered at the airport of the main city, Yangon. Many believe the military ordered the killing because he was fighting for ethnic minority rights and trying to change the Burmese constitution, which gives the army a great deal of power. Some of the men accused of his killing are back in court later, but there are grave doubts that justice will be done. Ko Ni's family have been talking to the BBC's Myanmar correspondent, Nick Beek.
Arrivals at Yangon International is much like any other big airport. Taxi drivers jostle for customers, reunited loved ones embrace. But what happened here 2 years ago was as unexpected as it was chilling.
Well, this is the spot. Ko Ni, a 63-year-old, highly respected Muslim lawyer, had just got back from a trip to Indonesia. He was holding his grandson in his arms here at the taxi queue. A photographer managed to capture the exact moment a gunman then walked up behind Ko Ni and pulled the trigger.
For me, he is a hero, and he can sacrifice everything for his belief and for his truth. For me, he is a very great man, and he is a very brave man.
Dr. Yinwei Kai is Ko Ni's eldest daughter. We meet in the family flat in downtown Yangon. She says justice for the killing must be delivered for her relatives and for the nation.
The justice means the punishment according to the law, not more or not less, because it is important for our country and our image of our country and what we call the rule of law. So I still hope to have a justice, but for me, it's a little bit losing hope, you know, not so much hope.
In the corner of the room hangs a photo of Ko Ni smiling alongside the country's civilian leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. As a legal advisor to her National League for Democracy ruling party, he'd been instrumental in efforts to change Myanmar's constitution. It automatically gives the military a quarter of MP seats, a veto in parliament, and control of three key ministries. A Muslim lawyer fighting for change in a predominantly Buddhist country, Ko Ni had made powerful enemies.
It is very terrible, the Ko Ni case. It is also a threat for us and all Democrats who want to abolish the constitution.
Thein Thanh Nhu is himself a leading lawyer, a former political prisoner, and was a close friend of Ko Ni. He wants to continue his work.
You've been involved at looking again at the constitution.
Yes.
Does that make you fearful for your own safety?
Oh, no, because I'm an old man. Now I am 65 years old. I did my times in prison for nearly 20 years. So I couldn't afraid. No, so I am to do my duty.
This week, on the second anniversary of the assassination, friends, family and foreign diplomats gathered to remember Ko Ni. The Burmese military continues to deny it was behind the murder. The suspected mastermind, a retired lieutenant colonel, is still on the run. Four other men, all linked to the army, are due back in court as a much-criticised trial reaches its conclusion.
Scott Marciel, U.S. ambassador to Myanmar. It's really a test, I think, of the Myanmar system, of whether after years of human rights violations with impunity, whether there can be justice done. And we certainly hope there can be.
That was Ambassador Scott Marciel ending that report by the BBC's Myanmar correspondent, Nick Beek. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. And a reminder of our top story today on NewsHour. The United States has confirmed it'll pull out of a key nuclear arms control treaty with Russia. Earlier, the former UN High Representative for Disarmament Affairs, Angela Kane, told us she was fearful of the consequences.
Ever since John F. Kennedy, you've had treaties between the then Soviet Union, now Russia, and the United States that have limited their deployment, they've limited missiles, they have limited nuclear weapons. They have gone down tremendously in number. And all of a sudden, you are pulling out as one of the last two treaties that still exist.
Also today, the Italian authorities have impounded a migrant rescue ship in Sicily. And the UN Refugee Agency has appealed for safe passage for civilians fleeing an upsurge in fighting in Syria. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. South Korea's launched its biggest ever investigation into sex abuse after numerous athletes came forward saying they were physically and sexually abused by their coaches. One of them has been telling her story to the BBC's Seoul correspondent, Laura Bicker.
The world of elite speed skating here in South Korea has been rocked by allegations of physical and sexual abuse. This is a country that has won 24 Olympic gold medals, but now the standards, the quality of the coaching is being brought into question. It all started last year when medalist Shim Seok-hee came forward. She said she had been beaten by her coach with a hockey stick. He broke her fingers. At some point, she feared for her life, she said. Now, the coach is behind bars. He's serving a prison sentence. But now Ms. Shim has come forward to say she was sexually abused. And she's not the only one. Another five women have come forward and raised their voices. We've been speaking to one of them anonymously.
What age did that start and what kind of physical abuse was there?
I was in my first year at high school, 16 years old. It was at a public space at an ice rink. My coach hugged me and kissed me. Or he would call me into a separate room alone and touch me. He texted me, "I love you," and asked me to go to a movie theater or have dinner. It lasted for 2 years, and then I left the team.
What did you think then? What was going through your brain? You're young at that time, so what were you thinking?
I felt dirty, shameful, but I couldn't say no to his face because I thought my life as an athlete would end if I left him or said no to him. The pressure was harsh. I was beaten heavily in elementary school. We used to suffer violence, beaten by badminton rackets or the plastic cover for skate blades. If we complained about the pain, the coach would verbally abuse us. Honestly, sexual harassment is a problem, but violence is a bigger problem. However, in skating, it's a given that you'd be beaten. It would have been considered strange if we had reported it. Why would you report it? Are you out of your mind? Keep quiet. No need to make a fuss about it. Because of the system of violence, we cannot resolve the situation.
What do you want to see happen to the man involved?
I try not to blame him, but looking back, I realize I quit skating because of him. However, he is bad-mouthing me now while continuing his normal life. I want him to suffer as much as I do.
Do you have faith that things will change?
It looks like it will change. It happened over and over again in Korea. People spoke out, it got swept under the rug, and perpetrators acted again. I grew up as a young athlete watching this cycle. Now Shim Seok-hee, our big sister, has spoken out, and other athletes have mustered their courage as well. Maybe now it is the time for a real change. Maybe we can ensure there won't be any more victims. I came forward with my story thinking that.
There might be other women across South Korea, across the world, who've suffered like you have. What message would you give them?
I would like to tell them that we shouldn't think that it is our fault. We are not to be blamed for what's happened to us. If you're feeling ashamed and let down, that means what's being done to us is a crime. We should seek help, let others know, and report on it. Don't suffer alone.
It's not just speed skating. Stars from the world of judo, from the worlds of tennis and football have all come forward to say they too were physically or sexually abused. Now, Seoul in South Korea might look glitzy and dynamic, but it remains a patriarchal society. It is difficult for women to question, especially men in power. But things are beginning to change. The Me Too movement is taking hold. And that is because a brave few women have decided to come forward with their stories.
And that was Laura Bicker reporting there from South Korea. Now, when Turkey launched a military operation against the Kurdish-dominated north of Syria a year ago and called it Operation Olive Branch, you'd be forgiven for assuming the name was the usual euphemistic propaganda that armies like to indulge in. Well, a year on, it seems as if that name's taken on a much more literal meaning. Olives have for centuries been a bedrock of the local economy in that part of Syria, but Turkey's now accused of working with its Arab militia allies to plunder the crop, making tens of millions of dollars in the process. Let's talk to Daniel Dawson, who's editor of the Olive Oil Times, and Daniel's been researching the story. Welcome to NewsHour. What sort of quantities of olive oil are we talking about, and what exactly happened to it?
Okay, so when Turkey invaded last January, they began raiding some of the olive mills. There are more than 100 olive mills in Afrin that was processing olives into olive oil. So far, according to Salah Ibo, he is the deputy chairperson for the Afrin Canton Agricultural Council, he says about 210,000 tons of olives have been taken from Afrin, which is about 80% of their total production, and that would yield roughly 70,000 tons of olive oil, depending on how efficiently it's been pressed.
And so what happened to it then?
And, well, that's part of that is the big question. You've got a lot of politicians in Spain and Switzerland in particular asking whether it's been sold into the European Union. Turkey just signed a recent trade deal with the EU that makes the sale of olive oil much easier into the bloc. And there are some reports that it's already entered European markets, but none of this has been confirmed. There are confirmations that it's entered the Gulf, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, as well as Cyprus. So the two Spanish senators have called on the European Commission and the Spanish government to open a formal investigation to see whether any international laws have been broken.
And is the allegation that this was just stolen, or did any money change hands with the local population in this part of Syria?
No, this has all been stolen. This has been seen by observers on the ground who spoke to El Publico, which initially broke the story, and by the United Kingdom-based Syria Observatory for Human Rights. They witnessed thousands of olive oil tanks being stolen in Afrin. They've witnessed kidnappings and coercion of the local population to harvest olives and then press them for these militias, which in turn received about reportedly $22 million from the Turkish government, which was laundered through the state bank and postal service, according to the ANF.
So this is basically taking the olive oil to pay for these militias to operate.
Yes, and then making some profit as well. It's estimated that Turkey earned so far about $80 million from the oil that's been produced from Afrin olives.
Fascinating stuff, and I'm sure more will come out on this story. We'll have to leave it there, though. That was Daniel Dawson, editor of the Olive Oil Times. That is it for this edition of NewsHour. From me and the rest of the team, thanks for listening. Until the next time, bye-bye.
NewsHour has been a download from the BBC. To discover more and our terms of use, visit bbc.com/podcasts.